shall miss your bright eyes and sweet smile, for you take with you all of the sunshine that has brightened our pathway a while. Then come say,
red has been a source of strength for me over my lifetime, a primary color. It's around plenty of daycares and kindergartens and nurseries. I remember it from United Lutheran Church, Viking Elementary, and in my own bedroom. My mother, actually, was an interior designer. She used it a lot in our house, wallpaper, carpet, and even picture frames. I had the opportunity to record with Jack White several years ago. So much fun. And the windows in his studio were tinted red. I felt so at home, although I don't know Jack that well. But I do know that he, too, has an affinity for color. And red must mean something similar to him as it does to me, the sort of blend of church and life and family and passion. The most iconic moment, perhaps, the first most special moment where the color red seared itself into my brain and has become a thing that is both part of my blood and what I feel I'm trying to recapture now that I'm 50, happened in the early 1980s when I saw it on TV with the advent of MTV.
I want my MTV!
MTV music television, video music, 24 hours a day, and a stereo!
Pop stars from the 1960s and 70s like Pat Benatar and Mick Jagger and Pete Townsend could now visually engage with their audiences in their own homes, reclining in their own easy chairs.
I want my MTV.
And every music lover had the chance to not only hear new music, but see who was doing the music and who was singing it. And Lord Almighty, there were some crazy videos back then when MTV first was invented. One of the weirdest, but one of the coolest, had to have been that video by Herbie Hancock, his song, Rocket. But nobody could compete with Michael Jackson and the moment he stepped out into his apartment hallway in the video to Beat It. That red leather jacket blinded me with beauty. It was a mythical jacket. It was on par with that baseball bat by Roy Hobbs, Wonder Boy, the thing from the gods. And it became the thing that I dreamed about before I went to sleep that night. This is the Great American Folk Show. My name is Tom Brousseau. It's a place where we commune with you to tell stories and sing some songs and talk to some good people with great voices. I'm going to highlight the life and career so far of Richard Buckner, whose impact on the singer-songwriter genre is indelible. His style on the mic and on the page is inimitable. No one can copy this guy. Nobody. This can be attributed to the fact that he remains an artist, always has, always will. He's an explorer, an observer, a painter, like Edward Degas. In a moment, I'll run my interview with him, stopping on a few occasions to spin the songs he sent in for the show. If you don't know his music, I'm sure you're going to enjoy what you're going to hear, his music and the conversation that we have. But if you're a fan of his music, then this broadcast will be the excellent companionable tote to what you might already have in your arsenal of his body of work. But first, years ago, I had the opportunity to do a month-long residency in Chicago at a place called Shuba's and call up some friends of mine, Kelly Hogan, Nora O'Connor, and old Scotty L to join me for a few tunes, one of them being one of my favorite Buckner tunes called Emma. Here's that song now.
Emma, I'm sorry for you. Emma, I'm sorry for you. Looks like the good Lord has given you up. Oh, Emma, I'm sorry for you.
Emma, I'm sorry for you.
Well, she loves the Cherokee City man.
She loves the Cherokee City man.
She loves
That was a Richard Buckner song.
And here in the house of spirits, there's a ghost with a drink. And he's gone through every opening, but the breaths just aren't as deep or wild. And less than there's ever really been. Quite a
We're on the phone with Richard Buckner, who's released 10 albums spanning the years 1994 to 2013. Lots of touring in there. Richard, you've even stopped in my hometown of Grand Forks a few times, and that's how I first got to know your music in 1998. Your most recent work is the poetry collection, Cuttings from the Tangle. You were on the Great American Folk Show in 2021. reading some of those poems. And whether it's a song or a poem, your writing is impressionistic, like a painter. And I want to dive into that a bit over the course of our interview because you give your audiences a unique experience. And certainly, whenever Richard Buckner releases anything, it's going to challenge, it's going to move, it's going to be great. Thank you for being on the Great American Folk Show.
Wow, thank you.
I'd like to start off today and just ask you a little bit about where you're from. I think you've lived in a few different places, but where do you hail from originally?
I hail from kind of a smear through central Northern California, primarily between, say, Redding and Bakersfield, with a few temporary jaunts to Humboldt, and then briefly below the Grapevine for just a few months because family is strictly Northern Californian.
Can you tell us, what that whole Northern California thing is all about? You mentioned Humboldt and Redding. This is an interesting part of Northern California.
Yeah, it's, the main separation between Northern and Southern that comes up, lightly is the whole water issue. and then, they are different worlds. Below the Grapevine is Los Angeles and everything that comes out of that. And Northern is fertile and rich and as well, but in a different kind of way. I can't even say if it's even liberal or conservative. It's kind of just everything. All the extremes and everything in between.
I love those Northern California towns. I think of, or Central, I think of Visalia. I think of Locke, Davis, the interesting little pockets, Yuba City, where mysteries just seem to be.
Yeah, so much of that area. I mean, we're talking anything from Grapes Verrast to the Donner Party, and all sorts of becoming the country of California almost with everything it offers. And yes, the little towns. I grew up in Yuba City, on and off here and there. And when I was there, it was one of the years that Rand McNally called it the worst city in the U.S. Marysville, right across the river, a mile away, where I also lived on and off, was the biggest little city in California and founded by some members of the Donner Party and other people, bankers and investors and that sort of thing. But the little towns are great, and they're still there. They're like, even the ones that aren't ghost towns are kind of like ghost towns. Last time I was out there, and there's specific places I love to wander in the foothills of Sierra Nevadas and, of course, through the Central Valley and the dozens and dozens of places, towns that I lived in over the course of my upbringing.
What are some of your fondest, earliest childhood memories of your upbringing?
The upbringing was, it was very scattered across the state. So it was an ongoing series of new experiences. So good or bad, moving into a new place and starting over again, or thinking you're starting over the clean slate every few months, and all the different kinds of towns and houses and places, other places we lived in. The circumstances for moving that much were fraught, with drama. But my eyes were wide, and I got to see a lot of things. And maybe even being a new person constantly, you see things in a new way all the time, which makes you into like kind of a more an observer.
My interview with Richard Buckner continues after I play you this song that he sent in. It's one of three, called Lil Wallet Picture. And what's so sort of biographical about this tune is the location that he mentions, the lyric, this stretch of 99 that takes so many lives. 99 is one of the north-south state routes in California, near where Richard grew up in Yuba City. And it's lined with these trees. It's quite beautiful, actually. I've driven it many times, but it can be deadly too. There are lots of roads that cross it, and as a result, there are a lot of crashes. Here's that tune.
Damn. spend. And too young to, I stumbled onto a picture of you. You wild bitter tale, all cherry oak and tears, as the branches look in. The summer is done, we are. And let the silent light in. Soon I'll be on that highway and there. The stretch of 99 will take so many lives. One of them was mine. So hand me that little picture in 1985 one more time. And the lights on the street when I'd walk to you at night were so blindly lit for a little flame. His, mine, and yours, and the torch in the attic. Well, I woke up late and kissed you away as you packed up your load. One last look, and then the U-Haul broke free, and the dishes are flooded all over the back room. Damn. The stretch of 99 to take so many lives. One of them was mine. So hand me that little wallet picture in 1985 one more time. The stretch of 99 that takes so many lives. One of them was mine. So hand me that little wallet picture in 1985 one more time. Underspent, too young to, I stumbled onto a picture of you.
Members of your family, mom, dad, siblings, musical, or were you the only one that excelled in that way?
No, in fact, almost exclusively non-musical. I can't think of anybody. There was a great-grandfather, Popo, from Alabama. He used to play fiddle on his hip. And then I had an Uncle Gene, who was a second marriage uncle to my mother's aunt. And Gene played jazz guitar and drank whiskey with his coffee in the morning. And had a laugh like a crying chopper.
Yeah. Did these family members encourage you, or did you take inspiration from what they did to create music yourself?
No, it was all an escape, and it was done in private with no one else involved. I pushed for it. Wherever we moved to, I'd usually find some place to start guitar lessons or work on something like that. But it was completely just myself. There was even a guitar recital once when I was a teenager with a private teacher, and she did a show of all of her students. And, you know, I could drive then, so I didn't even invite my family. I just did it. It was just for me.
Yeah, I would say that's a very personal experience. So when you would be practicing at home, then you were practicing in your room or somewhere shut off from the rest of your family?
Oh, yes. Yes, always the closed door of the bedroom and not shared with anybody. Music was late for me, so I didn't experience, I had guitars when I was growing up, but couldn't really play easy play songbooks, you know, like the Eagles or something like that, to learn songs. But really not mastering anything, just kind of learning basic chords and thinking about it. Listening to a lot of music, whatever they were, 8-tracks, cassettes, vinyl, radio, constantly monitoring music. And in California, the exciting thing each weekend was the pink section of the San Francisco Chronicle. That would a huge pullout on pink paper that would show all the upcoming tours and shows coming up and talk about coming music coming out, new releases. That was really exciting. And it gave me a chance to kind of see the outside world when I was still traveling from small town to small town. And San Francisco was the first larger town I moved to when I was able to.
And you moved to San Francisco as a teen, as a teen or early 20. You're old, and now you're able to go and see all of these different genres of music, these different clubs. Was that a part of your experience?
Yeah, the experience, I moved there when I was 21, or when I was 22, I moved there after I got out of college, and all I had was a motorcycle I was delivering food on, so I sold the motorcycle and moved to San Francisco and got a job in a bookstore that kind of set me on a course that I was already on, but still a course that was more like working in a bookstore and the people who work there as well can supply you with a different kind of knowledge or a different way of looking at things, you know, which was important. It's going to a town that did have regular shows and more access to the arts.
So you found a community?
Not immediately. I had a few friends I moved around with here and there. But San Francisco is one of those places that, you know, no matter what your twist is, you can explore it. And I did a lot of that exploring alone, but was also turned on to a lot of things by people I knew, whether it was music or different places, parts of town that had different kinds of things going on. San Francisco is such a quilt of different things. You really, it seems limitless, even though you might be, think you're bored at the time. You're not bored. You're just exploring.
Out of curiosity, what was the name of that bookstore?
It was called Acorn Books. It was a really nice store in the Tenderloin on Polk Street, which the street itself is quite a character parade. And the store inside was just like an oasis of beautiful, rare books. And yeah, $5 an hour.
Did you read a lot, always been an avid reader, or just like being around books?
My family really wasn't. You know, we had the requisite Reader's Digest condensed library on the shelves and a bunch of things like that. So I did the reading on my own. I mean, luckily, the great thing about schools, elementary schools then, was no matter where I did move, there was usually some sort of program where you could order books in class, or they had those magazines like Bananas or things like that you could order, and once every couple weeks you get, like, you could order a new book. And I did a lot of reading that way. You know, some were real books, some were things like the book adaptation of Jaws or something, you know. So I read a lot of everything, but not much, there wasn't much discussion of books or literature or music or stuff around the house. Back then, you know, I had the all-around, you know, the all-inclusive place called Tower Records, where you can go for the books, records, T-shirts, you know, everything was there, and the music was complete. And it was like those kind of places, I think, really like educated me as much as, you know, anything else. because you're just left to explore there alone and go off on your own. Like, it was like walking around a library, which I would also do sometimes, you know, coming home from school. I would just go to the library and go to some room and read a book about movie monsters or something, you know?
Get lost a little bit in the library.
Get lost, exactly.
Why the guitar? Was there any other instrument that, you know, you could have gone to? Was the guitar just something that was available? Was it the fact that it's a somewhat portable instrument? Why the guitar?
I can only think that's why I had it. We never lived anywhere long enough to have something like a piano or anything like that. And the guitar was something that I could have and not have to share with anybody. It could be quiet. So there were a couple like cheap guitars along the way when I was growing up that came and went. And I didn't have a, you know, real guitar for a period of time until probably I got into college. Before I started college, I found like a cheap solid body with a cheap amp, you know, for a couple hundred bucks. When I was working at a record store and I was like 18, that was my first like electric thing. And then after that, I kind of went through a number of, you know, guitars. Junkers are nice ones here and there. That was portable. And it was portable when I was, you know, moving, not only when I was growing up every few months, but like when I moved to, say, San Francisco and living in like residential hotels, you know, a small room somewhere. You pretty much only have like a guitar and a bag and a few other things you can bring with you because there's just no room and you have to move on like the municipal bus or something.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Great American Folk Show. We are on the phone with songwriter and poet Richard Buckner. Richard, when did it all really start happening for you in terms of, you know, songwriting, where you saw a future in it? And then you started to do it. When did all that take place?
A friend of mine, the manager of the record store I worked at when I turned 18, had one of the first cassette four tracks. He was kind of a jazzy guitar player, and I loved it. I loved the thought of it, and didn't get one of my own until I think about the time I moved to San Francisco, and I had it in a little closet, and I started like multi-tracking. Which really made me write. I wasn't interested in like songwriting per se on an instrument for no reason, but home recording got me thinking because I'm just thinking more in terms of sounds, and words were secondary. It was just an interesting thing to do, to layer tracks of noise, and you know, I couldn't really play. It was just, I was discovering things haphazardly, and that's when I kind of started writing, and that would be like, I don't know, 89 or something like that, and from there it led to writing other songs. I had tried stuff in college because I had a couple bands I tried to put together. We did mostly covers, but there were a couple early songs I tried there then too that I'm really glad nobody's ever heard.
What cover songs did you guys do? Like the Eagles, that kind of thing, or no, something a little bit more like college?
I don't think we did the Eagles, and we did like jokey things. Like we did like, you know, in college, I was a creative writing major. So we had a song, one of our songs, you know, we were heavily influenced by the music going on at the time. So like at times, like great stuff, like psychedelic furs, that area of music. And so I remember we did like that song from the first record. Each line starts out, "I'm in love with," and they goes on to describe certain things. But we filled in the I'm in love with things about our English department. Because the two of us were in an English department together. So there was a supervisor named Lennis Dunlap, who was very stern, and you didn't want to cross him, and it was hard to get a good grade out of him. So we had "I'm in love with Lennis Dunlap. I'm in love with the English department." You know, like things. So it was kept kind of, you know, half-hearted, but trying to rock.
And what college was this? Where did you go to school?
I ended up my last couple years at Chico State. I did junior college for a few months in Oroville and then moved for a year to Idaho to a Mormon junior college. I wasn't religious, but a good friend of mine who I liked a lot was. And so I somehow got in for a year there and lived with like four ex-missionaries. And I was 19 and, you know, in my opinion, Mormon kids are wilder than Catholic kids. So it was, you know, it wasn't exactly a straight time there, like Rumspringa, but for Mormons. It was primarily, I think, an opportunity for me to leave where I'd grown up and escape everything and try to just being away from everything I knew. And then when I went back, I thought I was going to go down to Southern California to go to a state college down there, but I changed my mind at the last minute and just ended up at Chico because it's cheaper and easier and kind of familiar terrain.
Do you remember the first full song that you wrote, finished writing it, and you thought to yourself, I think I'm onto something?
No. It's all always been just like pure searching and accidentally stumbling upon something you keep doing for some reason. There's no like, there's never been like a pride where I felt I'd done something. It's more like something I just wish I could keep to myself, but due to the nature of what it is, shared.
Do you still feel that way?
Yes. Absolutely. In every respect, I want to be invisible.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Great American Folk Show. We are on the phone with Richard Buckner. Thank you again for visiting with us. I realized I've hardly asked you any of the questions that I've written down, but I love it because I think the conversation is just going in the way that it's going to go. We were talking about songwriting. Songwriting is, for some, it's very personal and it remains that way. And for others, you know, they stumble upon a formula, and the pursuit then might be to continue doing that and to make money doing that. But I've always considered you an artist in the true sense of the word. When we began this conversation, I called you impressionistic. You've got a unique way. Do you see yourself having evolved as a songwriter?
No, it's a series of manias, a series of sections of time with their own problems and their own experiences that is just like, I don't know, translated in the different ways that I am putting the words down or how I want the music to make me feel. It's a series of stops and starts. And I mean, yeah, evolution or, you know, maybe just a trail would be better.
Any pressure from agents or, you know, record execs to be a certain way?
No, in fact, it's the opposite. I'm never something that's a commodity, I think. I've never felt like there was any kind of thing that was wanted of me because there was nothing possible to want. I kind of skirt around the outskirts, you know.
It's been a while since you've released a record. You had this collection of poetry that came out in 2021, Cuttings from the Tangle, which I really loved. But in terms of releasing albums, it's been a while. Are you refueling the receptacles?
There have been abandoned projects that have taken years. I mean, between 2013 and when I put the book out, there was a long story, a story song compilation I was trying to put together, which I did a lot of writing for and dabbled in on and off for a few years. There was another record that I thought I had enough songs for that I tried to record and in about 2018, and it failed in the studio. And then there's been a bunch of other writing I've done. And there was also somewhere before the last record, there's also some incidental music that I made. So there's been a lot of work done, but I don't, like I said, I'm not a commodity that there's low demand, let me just say. I really don't have an inkling to chase it around. I didn't before. I just kind of took advantage of what was offered to me, whether tours or opportunities or a chance to record and do something. But I have a lot of work at home to do, and I do it and put it in a drawer or work on it and just think. I don't see the point really of putting something out, especially with the way the things are now with getting music out there. I mean, I don't necessarily know if I need a label or want a label. I can put stuff out on my own through social media if I want, which I experiment with. And it's great because you can put it out, and if you don't like it, delete it. You know, no, like, I wish I hadn't put that on the record. Like, well, I'll just delete it.
Yeah, things have changed quite a bit since you first started in the record industry.
Yes. I was kind of the tail end of the boilerplate record deal. I know the people who experienced it as well. Shortly before, everything kind of got skewed even more so in royalties and and distribution. So I got a taste of it, which was kind of cool, being in that kind of environment, you know, being in the same mastering studio that Tom Petty or Rush mastered in, you know. It's like, what am I doing here? Or a label that put out records you love like that, but then also being on a cool independent label where you, you know, idolize a lot of people on the same label as you. It's like, you know, it's an honor, but it's not necessarily the place to be. Yeah.
And of course, the other side to that is you've got a new record out. Now you have to tour. You've not toured. I think you do occasional shows. People ride in and maybe invite you into their home to play, which is must be a lot of fun to do. But the grand tours that you've done, do you miss doing that?
I miss driving around. I always said the touring was more like an excuse. The shows were an excuse to tour. It was driving around mostly alone, usually alone, and going anywhere I wanted and observing from my, you know, what I thought was invisibility, you know, various towns and situations you stumble upon. That was the greatest part about touring. Shows can be, you know, can be intimidating for various reasons, good and bad. And I just feel like the club shows were great and terrible. The living room shows, the acoustic shows I was doing were mostly great because it kind of brought me out of a shell I was in. I was actually in spaces that weren't behind a curtain or late at night. It was in somebody's house, you know, at a reasonable hour. I played a lighthouse. The next night I played somebody's living room. The next night I played, you know, a roastery. So it was nice in that way. The business end of things was much easier because I didn't deal with money every night. Those shows, they all just went through the person who put them together. And at the end, we added it up and split the money. There was no like going to some coked out, drunk promoter at the end of the night expecting them to carefully count your tickets, you know. It's, the end of the night at shows and club shows is always anxious.
But you would have to deal with that, doing those long tours, not the living room tours, but, you know, the long tours, you're the person who's driving, you're the person who's toting in all of the equipment. And so at the end of the night, you're the last person to leave to have that conversation with the owner to collect the money that they owe you.
Yes. And like I said, a lot of times they're not at a sharp state of mind. Some permanently, some just that night, but you have to deal with them reasonably and sometimes unreasonably. And that takes a toll as well. I'm not like a real chatty kind of a social person. I guess I could be at times a long time ago when I was drinking more and made me a little more social, but I'm not naturally like that. And I'm not naturally easy around people. So when you get in those situations where you have to be socially easy in a situation where it's absurd, it takes a lot of energy, let's say.
Yeah, in that sense, it kind of forces you to be someone that you're not and adds another check to the, you know, just the general unhealthiness of the touring lifestyle.
Yeah. Healthy in a way that for me is like getting to explore the world and having open road and open opportunities, you know, however they may fall in front of you. I really, really love the open road. That's the best part of it. You're alone, you know, you're talking to yourself while you're driving, addressing, you know, old enemies or situations that nobody will hear about. A lot of therapy gets done.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Great American Folk Show. This is our interview with Richard Buckner. Richard, I want to direct your attention to one of your albums in particular called The Hill. Came out in 2002. A really gorgeous record. I feel like around that time, we were starting to take a look back at some of the past American greats, the Carter Family, for example, and Woody Guthrie. And then you came out with this record where you did something similar. You're shining a light on a past great, only your light was a little bit stronger, and it saw back even further than all of the rest. and you were shining the light on Edgar Lee Masters. And this record has been one that I've listened to millions of times. It's a beautiful record, and I'm curious about it. So this is the fourth release that you had, and I'm curious as to why you felt like you wanted to go into that direction after having released three acclaimed solo records. It seemed like you were really starting to make an impression on your own work, and then you come out with The Hill. What was the reason for that? You just interested in doing something different? You had this project in the works for a little while?
Sort of, in the works, in the glove compartment. Before I made my second record in Tucson, on the way to Tucson, I wasn't living anywhere. I stopped for a week at a motel in near Death Valley, and I had a four-track cassette recorder and a paperback copy of The Hill, of Spoon River's anthology, which is probably the one I lifted when I worked at that bookstore in the Tenderloin in San Francisco years before. I stocked shelves and occasionally took a few cheap ones. And I had it with me a week off. And my time off is spent alone working on projects and thinking. So I had this room in this hotel, not even a hotel. It was like the property used to be the hunting cabin for Howard Hughes. And it was a main house and a couple buildings and a couple garages. My room was what used to be one of the garages. And the house was in no way fancy or anything. It was just an old house that's kind of falling apart. Out and back, there was an airstrip, a dirt airstrip beyond a barbed wire fence. And I was in this room, which was, I think, half of a garage. They split it into two rooms with, I don't think it had a phone or anything. And just my four track and the book. And I spent the week there. And then I'd drive, 15 miles in one direction to the one restaurant in the area and serve like cowboy food, beans and cornbread and stuff, and then go back there. And then, so I have the original cassette, and I think it was like six or seven songs I came up with. And then I put the cassette in my glove compartment of my pickup truck and forgot about it for a couple of years. And then years later, somebody who was borrowing my truck found it and said, "What's this?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah." And I listened to it, I was like, "Oh, I remember that." I was at the time I was trying to make a record, writing songs, and I kind of hit a dry wall, and so I turned to that instead, and ended up not planning to make it. I just turned to the project as to keep my hands from being idle, and to keep thinking, and maybe work myself, not consciously thinking this, but work myself out of this whatever dry run I was in. And so I rented this little room. I rented it in Edmonton, Alberta. It was like a small exam room, very small, in this building that used to be a dentist medical building, a dentist office. And this little room was as big as a closet, a walk-in closet. And I had an 8-track mini disc recorder they just came out with then. And I had that in there with like a mic and a single pre and a couple of instruments. And I just went through the book and read through it, and came up with a lot of instrumental ideas that some became beds for the words, the poems that I selected, and some stayed instrumental interpretations of the poem. And it happened very organically. I mean, I wasn't trying to make a record, and I didn't think it was a record. I was just screwing around, really, with this book. And then the kind of basic equipment I had, I didn't have any way to really mix it down on anything except a CD burner that only burns it as one track. So I made a one track version of it and just liked it. I thought it was exactly what I wanted to be. I didn't plan on being one track, but it had to be that. So I released it as a one track 17 song kind of cycle after I had it kind of retuned here and there at a studio in Tucson.
Well, I remember that. I listened to this album on the listening station back when, you could do that at record stores, and it was one track that was 18 parts long.
Yeah,
that was unusual. This isn't really how CDs are released. It was unusual.
Yeah, I like that. I like that about it. I was working on it on a machine that I bought with money that the major label had given me to work on demos for an assumed third record. And it wasn't much. It wasn't even enough for a day in the studio, and I thought it was a waste of money. So instead, I took the money and bought my 8-track mini disc recorder, which I still use to this day. It's my primary recorder now, still. So I got it out of a scam. And luckily, the label dropped me before I could turn in this 17-song, 1-track cycle of based on 100-year-old poems. That would put the nail in the coffin if they didn't hate me already. A win-win.
We pause once more to listen to a second song that Richard sent in. It's quite a thrill to have these unique recordings. This one is Julia Miller, his collaboration with Edgar Lee Masters. It's about a woman who is in an impossible situation, one she can see no way out of. I encourage you to check out Richard Buckner's album, The Hill. Did you have any conversation or communication with the Edgar Lee Masters estate?
No. In fact, I haven't even totally explored the place. I've been through a number of times, but usually on off days or I don't have time to really do it. I did find time once to visit a museum there, and I dropped off a record. I'm not sure if it was the main museum or not. It was only open a few months a year. And then there's either that time or another time I went there, and what I wanted to visit was closed, some other museum or historic site. But at a national park, they had a log cabin reenactors from that time. And they had, like in the gift shop of the state park, they had like a box of little mini Lincoln beards that children could buy. So I went around this reenactor log cabin park with children wearing Lincoln beards and reenactors. And that's the closest I've gotten to Spoon River.
I've always thought that maybe it was intended, you'd written it, and that the hope might have been that it would be turned into a stage show of some sort with a storyline. Because, you know, half the record is you singing, the other half is instrumental. Or I always thought, well, maybe Richard Buckner will release like a part two, because there's, you know, 244 of those poems to the anthology. And you just seem to really just seem to have interpreted this body of work is the thing. So I've always felt like you must have really connected with this book.
Yes. on so many levels. just the pure eavesdropping nirvana of hearing these people's versions of the same story, multiple versions of the same story, which, you know, teaches you a lot about human nature and experience. And yeah, I did visualize it. The weird thing is, you know, when I was in that cabin in the desert, when I initially had the four-track cassette recorder in the book, it was strange at that diner 15 miles away in the middle of nowhere. I'm not sure what town they were advertising for. When I went there, there was a poster in the window for a high school adaptation of Spoon River Anthology. And I was like, oh my God, this has been done? I hadn't even heard of the book before I took it from the bookstore, because my upbringing, I missed a lot of education and missed a lot of literature. And it was something I discovered on my own after I was finished completely with school, college, and everything. So then I saw this poster. I was like, oh my God. And I in a record store, I don't know, not much later, I found a vinyl version of the stage play, which I think was musical. Honestly, I've never heard it because I thought, like, I shouldn't hear this. but on the version I have, I think Julie Andrews was in it. But I never had that record played during the, you know, as an elementary school or anything. You know, this great, like, was it the Cardamon series of authors reading their own works and stuff? I have like a 6 vinyl version series on vinyl of E. E. Cummings doing a series of lectures back then that I just adore.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Great American Folk Show. We've been visiting with Richard Buckner, poet, musician, and songwriter. Richard, I've taken up a lot of your time, and I don't want to wear out my welcome either. And I have an idea, and that would be to do a part 2 interview in the near future, and we can revisit some of the other questions that I didn't ask, which is, turns out, most of them I didn't. But I've just really enjoyed talking with you today, and I really want to thank you for your time.
Well, guys, I thank you. I mean, like, I haven't done something like this in a long time, and you made it easy, and I appreciate your way of doing things. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, you can clear the door to another room. bottom of the lights. Stray back, although it's just too far the way we are.
This weekend marks the 40th anniversary of the annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Medora, North Dakota. It's run by Bill Lohman, and it has every year, and his wife, Joanne. They are salt of the earth people. It features working cowboys and cowgirls who sing original songs and recite poetry from places like Fargo and Valley City, Jamestown, McCluskey, Turtle Lake, Rame, and Sentinel Butte. It's a tradition that is important and vital, and it lives because there's somebody there to tell it, but then there's somebody there to hear it. Meryl Pepcorn MCs this year in honor of it. I want to play a song that I recorded from the Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering a couple of years when I was there and had such a good time. I haven't played this one on the radio yet. This is Peggy Douglas, one of her songs. She's from Hill City, South Dakota. She's going to take us out with a little bit of a tune called I Love You. Thanks for listening to the Great American Folk Show today. And thanks to Richard Buckner. I'm Tom Brousseau. May you always find that sun until we meet again.
Here we go. I love your boots. I love your hat. I love your silver spurs jangling with each step. I love your jeans and your great big belt buckle that you won years ago at the rodeo. But most of all, I love singing with you with a campfire burning beneath the Milky Way. Sleeping in canvas tents, rounding up buffalo. Most of all, I love you. I love your voice, the way you talk real straight. I love the way you walk with your cowboy gait, drinking cowboy coffee from the big blue pot, passing it round for another ghost.